This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is Jenny Pleeman reading today's front page of the Wall Street Journal for Tuesday, May 14th, 2024. Cohen testifies, Trump told him to drag out hush money talks, get past the election. Testimony from former president's loyalist turned nemesis is critical to prosecution's case. New York, New York. Michael Cohen, the star witness in Donald Trump's hush money trial, told jurors Monday the then presidential candidate directed him to make a payment to silence a porn star whose story he feared could derail his 2016 election bid. Cohen testified in a Manhattan courtroom that in the final stretch of the former president's first campaign, adult film actress Stormy Daniels threatened to come forward with her allegation of an affair with Trump at a golf event a decade earlier. Trump was fuming because he thought Cohen, his longtime personal lawyer and fixer, had handled the matter 5 years earlier, Cohen told the jury. I thought you had this under control, Cohen said Trump told him, later instructing, just take care of it. Trump told Cohen to drag out any negotiations on payment as long as possible. Just get past the election, Cohen said Trump told him. I win, it has no relevance because I'm president, and if I lose, I don't really care. Trump, this year's presumptive Republican presidential nominee, looked away from the witness stand with his eyes closed as Cohen testified. Unlike other days in the trial, some high-profile Trump supporters filled the courtroom pews at times behind the former president. In addition to his son Eric Trump, Senator J.D. Vance, Republican from Ohio, Representative Nicole Malliotakis, Republican from New York, and Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican from Alabama, attended the morning session. Cohen, the former president's loyalist-turned-nemesis, is flawed but critical witness. He is the only person likely to provide direct evidence that Trump himself ordered a cover-up of a payment to Daniels. He also pleaded guilty in 2018 to 9 federal crimes, including 2 that he said he carried out at Trump's direction, and he spent more than a year in prison. He was disbarred and has become a vocal Trump critic who has at times run into trouble for his off-the-cuff comments while under oath. Prosecutors on Monday interspersed records of phone calls and text messages throughout Cohen's testimony, providing documentation of most interactions he described. A prosecutor repeatedly asked Cohen about Trump's tendency to micromanage and the former lawyer's compulsion for his boss's praise to shore up the idea that the fixer would never take any action without the former president's approval. Cohen, who regularly attacks Trump on his podcast and social media accounts, was more demure on the witness stand. His testimony was straightforward, with many questions answered with, "Yes, ma'am." Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records related to his alleged role in covering up a hush money payment to Daniels. Prosecutors allege Trump directed payments to Daniels and others to silence their stories on the eve of the 2016 election. Trump has pleaded not guilty and denied having the affairs. On Tuesday, Trump's lawyers will have plenty of fodder for cross-examination. They're likely to argue, as they did in questioning Daniels, that Cohen has built a career off attacking Trump. He wrote 2 books about his time with Trump, Disloyal, a memoir, and Revenge, and has his own podcast. They could also point to his social media and any inconsistencies in his testimony. On the stand Monday, Cohen told jurors how he left a private firm in 2007 to go work for the Trump Organization, where he regularly bullied reporters, threatened to file lawsuits, and spoke to Trump several times a day. Cohen told jurors that Trump taught him specific ways of doing business. Trump instructed him that emails are like written papers, Cohen said, and that people had gone down due to prosecutors having emails they could use in a case. Prosecutor Susan Hoffinger asked if it was accurate to describe Cohen as Trump's fixer. It's fair, Cohen said. Cohen said Daniels first came up in 2011 when the gossip website The Dirty published a story about her alleged affair with Trump. When Cohen asked if Trump had had an affair, his boss did not answer, although Trump did say Daniels was beautiful, Cohen told jurors. Cohen then asked Trump if he should make the story go away. He said, absolutely, do it. Take care of it, Cohen testified. Then in August 2015, Cohen said he met with Trump and his friend David Pecker, then the publisher of the National Enquirer, and hatched a plan to boost Trump's candidacy. Cohen said the trio silenced three stories, one false story from a doorman about a Trump love child, as well as stories from Daniels and Playboy playmate Karen McDougal. During the McDougal deal, Cohen said he updated Trump every step of the way. Effectively, the story has now been caught, Cohen said he told Trump. Fantastic. Great job, Cohen said, quoting Trump and imitating his voice. Later, he updated Trump on the mechanics of buying the life rights to McDougal's story, which he said he did for his boss and not himself. What I was doing at the direction of and for the benefit of Mr. Trump, Cohen said. When the Wall Street Journal subsequently published an article about the McDougal payment just days before the 2016 election, Cohen said he yelled at Daniel's lawyer, accusing him of leaking the story and angering Trump. After the Daniels allegations emerged, Cohen said he followed his boss's instructions to drag out the deal. But when he heard the Daily Mail could publish Daniels' story before the election, Cohen said the matter became urgent. Trump gave him the green light, Cohen said. He expressed to me, just do it, Cohen told the jury. He said his boss's urgency was not because of his wife, Melania Trump, but concerns about how the story would play with voters. But complicating matters, he said, was who would fund the $130,000 payment. Pecker refused to do it, and the Trump Organization's chief financial officer also balked at the possibility, saying he wasn't in a financial position to do so, Cohen said. Cohen said that with the campaign facing a potential catastrophe, he made the payment himself, discussing the matter with Trump in late October. He said the former president promised to repay him. Everything required Mr. Trump's sign-off, he told the jury. On top of that, I wanted the money back. Temu cools on the United States after shelling out billions. App looks to reduce reliance on American shoppers as growth slows and scrutiny of TikTok grows. The bargain app Temu, which has gained spectacular popularity with American consumers, is shifting business priorities beyond the U.S., people close to the company said. Temu, owned by Chinese e-commerce giant PDD Holdings, wants to limit risks and seek other sources of growth. One catalyst for the shift is TikTok's troubles with the U.S. government. Temu is focusing more on acquiring users in Europe and other countries. As a result, it now expects less than a third of its sales to come from the United States this year, compared with 60% last year, a prediction earlier reported by the business publication The Information. It is a notable strategy shift for a company that in less than 2 years became the U.S.'s second most popular shopping app after Amazon.com by monthly users, attracting them with its $5 water dispensers and $3 t-shirts. Temu said that its expansion to new markets does not reflect a reduced emphasis on the U.S. The retailer said it is looking to build a global e-commerce platform and that its decisions are not driven by the experience of another company. Temu's Super Bowl ad blitz in February centered on the slogan, "Shop like a billionaire," highlighted its rise in American shopping. It also helped fuel a political firestorm around apps with Chinese roots. Then came the TikTok bill, requiring the popular video app's Chinese owner to either sell it or face a U.S. ban. TikTok's prolonged crisis, despite years of costly efforts to address Washington's data security concerns, has served as a wake-up call for Temu and its Chinese parent. Worries about similar actions against Temu have percolated among the PDD leadership since late 2022, when the Biden administration threatened to ban TikTok and had prompted Temu to speed up expansion in non-U.S. markets. When the House passed the TikTok bill in March, those fears intensified and a decision was made that Temu should move faster to reduce its reliance on the U.S. market. Temu's foraging for new growth opportunities also comes as the app's U.S. advantages show signs of losing steam. U.S. sales continue to grow, but at a slower pace, according to Earnest Analytics. In the United States, Temu's ad spending is increasingly focused on retaining users rather than attracting new ones. Temu has shelled out billions to acquire new U.S. users. PDD said Meta nearly $2 billion for ads last year and was also a top advertiser at Google, the Wall Street Journal has reported. It is still one of the top social media advertisers, particularly on Facebook, but Temu has pivoted more of its ad spending to Europe and other markets this year, said Seema Shah at market intelligence firm Sensor Tower. By April, the U.S. made up 38% of its total ad dollars, compared with 63% in the fourth quarter in 2023, she said. In the United States, the number of people who use Temu at least once a month shrank to 50 million in the first quarter, down 10% from the 55.6 million peak in last year's third quarter, according to Sensor Tower. Monthly users in the rest of the world surged 128% in the same period. Temu's shift comes as it faces a series of legal and compliance challenges. Washington legislators have accused both Temu and its China-founded rival, Shine, a fashion bargain app, of selling goods that may have been made using forced labor. The push is part of U.S. efforts to target Beijing's treatment of Uyghurs in China's Xinjiang region, which lawmakers have labeled as genocide. U.S. law bars most imports with links to Xinjiang. Temu said the forced labor allegations are completely unfounded. The company last year told a China-focused U.S. congressional committee that it did not explicitly prohibit the selling of products from Xinjiang, but by third-party vendors. It has since said it prohibits its suppliers from using forced labor. Shine said it has zero tolerance for forced labor. Temu's assurances have not satisfied U.S. lawmakers. Ahead of the Super Bowl, lawmakers as well as attorneys general in several states called on CBS to pull Temu's ads from the lineup. Lawmakers also accused Temu and Shine of taking unfair advantage of a U.S. tax exemption that lets goods worth $800 or less enter the U.S. tariff-free and without scrutiny. U.S. labor unions and manufacturing trade groups have joined to support bipartisan legislation that would bar Chinese companies from benefiting from the rule. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security in April said it would heighten scrutiny of low-value packages sent to U.S. customers. Temu and Shine both say the tax exemption is not critical to their success. Temu also faces two lawsuits alleging it collected more information from U.S. users than disclosed. The U.S. has feared that American user data collected by apps with China-based parents could fall into the hands of Beijing. Temu said the allegations have no merit and that its app is independently certified as meeting strict data security standards. Both TikTok and Shine have worked to address criticism in the United States. Temu, which faces similar challenges, appears to have taken a less intense approach. Temu said it engages with regulators and other stakeholders in all the markets where it operates. Since 2022, TikTok's parent, ByteDance, has spent $16.4 million on lobbying U.S. policymakers. Shine, whose plans for a U.S. listing have faced unusual delays, has spent $3.4 million on federal lobbying activities. Temu so far has not invested in lobbying, according to Open Secrets, a nonpartisan platform tracking political contributions. Over the past year, TikTok has expanded its U.S. presence, which TikTok executives believed would make the app more difficult to ban. It has also increased its engagement with users and spent $1.5 billion on a data use compliance project. Shine remains focused on U.S. expansion and has made compliance a strategic priority. The company has recently set up a legal and compliance center and plans to spend $50 million on global compliance, according to a person close to the company. Temu said it does not quantify compliance expenses, but has made substantial investments, such as expanding its product compliance and intellectual property protection teams, and invested in technology to better oversee its processes. While Temu still sees the United States as an important market, it has grown more cautious about investing there. Instead of building fulfillment centers in the U.S., Temu is looking to establish one in Mexico, from which parcels can be delivered to U.S. shoppers. Some vendors said Temu had cracked down on problematic products, such as counterfeit Lego sets, but that its product checks aren't as rigorous as other platforms. Timu said that the company has a rigorous quality control process that is more stringent than those of its competitors to ensure compliance with the regulations and standards of the markets where it operates. For the first time, PDD co-founder Chen Li told analysts in a call in March that Timu faces many uncertainties and challenges ahead, and that the company will strive to communicate and cooperate with regulatory bodies where Timu operates. The same month, Goldman Sachs downgraded PDD stock to neutral from buy, citing geopolitical risks, among other reasons. Why is inflation so stubborn? Ask your local small business. Many operations squeezed by higher costs say they plan to keep raising prices. Aluminum and cardboard keep getting more expensive. So do health insurance and wages. Small business owners say they are just a few of the reasons they plan to raise prices again this year. We have death by a thousand paper cuts, said Reed Baker, president of Supergraphics, a commercial printer in Seattle. The 50-person firm routinely updates its software so that increases in the cost of materials can be incorporated into new estimates as quickly as possible. Management has also begun uncomfortable conversations with customers about boosting overhead and labor charges to reflect higher operating costs. I almost feel like it's a momentum thing in the marketplace, said Baker, whose company makes large signs used in retail displays and corporate branding. Someone else is doing it. I need to do it to keep up. The cost pressure squeezing small businesses and their need to pass along those higher charges help explain why inflation has been so stubborn. The Federal Reserve this month highlighted a lack of further progress toward bringing inflation down and said it was holding interest rates at their highest level in two decades. More than half of small business owners said that they plan to raise prices in the next 12 months, according to a survey of more than 450 entrepreneurs conducted in April by Vistage Worldwide. 64% of those surveyed said that they had increased prices in the 12 months prior, according to business coaching and peer advisory firms. Penny Mendelson, president of McFarr, a commercial roofing company in Westbury, New York, said that the business rarely adjusted prices in the decade before COVID hit. That approach became unsustainable as costs for materials and labor jumped by 45% or more over a two-year period during the pandemic. The family-owned company raised its rates by a total of as much as 10% between 2020 and 2023 and will increase them again by another 2-5% this year. We've increased more in the last 4 years than we had in 10, said Mendelson, a fourth-generation roofer. We don't have a choice. Unlike large corporations, small businesses typically don't have large staffs that focus on costs and pricing, making adjusting to rapidly rising costs more challenging. We don't have a team in place that constantly goes back and evaluates all our contracts and all our vendors. Literally, it's me, said Elise Makarix, founder of AMB Architects, which specializes in small commercial projects. The 11-person Houston Our architecture firm is raising hourly rates by 20% this year. It also is reviewing client accounts to determine which ones need to be renegotiated in response to higher costs that have eroded profit margins. Some small businesses fear that further price hikes could alienate customers. McCarowix worries that some clients could put contracts out for rebid, but she said doing nothing isn't an option given that small businesses like hers typically operate with modest cash cushions. If we're a small business and don't go through this process, we don't have the runway to weather a downturn, she said. If I have to lay someone off because I can't afford to keep them, that's a big, huge deal. Four of AMB Architects' employees have been with the firm for 17 of its 19 years. Pushing back on higher costs often isn't much of an option these days. Barek Awent, chief executive of American Drapery Systems, a Minneapolis-based provider and maker of commercial window treatments, recently asked one vendor for a better deal. The answer? The supplier would waive the $150 shipping charge on orders of $10,000 or more. It used to be that I could negotiate, he said. The company is looking at creative ways to bring in new jobs at a lower cost. But real growth is harder to come by, Awent said, because even if we are selling more, we are making less. the company continues to face higher costs. Aluminum used for curtain tracks now costs $1.31 a foot, up from $1.19 in October. Facility Improvement Corporation, a provider of building automation and security systems, recently tried asking for a change in orders in an effort to adjust the pricing contract signed a few years ago. I wouldn't say that we get laughed at, but almost, said Chief Executive Shane Jett. The Great Falls, Montana company, which has more than 50 employees, acts as a subcontractor on larger projects. We are held to the standard of the contracts above us, Jett said. The company has raised its labor and materials pricing for all new estimates and last year began projecting labor costs a few years out instead of relying on current wage rates. The company also has started employing dynamic pricing, a strategy that allows it to charge higher rates for new jobs when the order book is nearly full. Higher labor costs are the biggest source of pain, with more than 80% of entrepreneurs reporting that increases in wages and benefits are having a significant impact on their businesses, according to an April survey of more than 1,200 small businesses by Goldman Sachs. A.J. Neely, the owner of Neely Tire and Auto in Edgewater, Maryland, recently handed one technician a 25% raise to keep him from decamping to a competitor. Last year, I had a lot of poachers coming at my technicians trying to steal them away, said Neely, who employs 30 people. Gross margins on charges for services that involve labor are hovering around 65%, below the company's target of 70% or so. I'm eating a good amount of that, said Neely, who has implemented two increases in labor rates totaling 10% in the past 12 months. The auto repair and tire store has added four new locations in the past 3 years. Neely is leveraging that purchasing power to secure better pricing and vendor rebates that can help soften the blow from higher labor costs. We're trying to compete with some of the big players, he said. I want to be able to cut costs and scale to where we don't have to impose a lot of price increases. At Supergraphics, the Seattle printing company, Baker started the year expecting inflation to cool, but that has not been the case. Corrugated prices have climbed 30% or more since 2020, while health insurance premiums jumped 18% last year. Starting pay now stands at $22 an hour, up from $18 a few years back. Third-party contractors who install signage for jobs outside the Seattle area have been responsible for some of the biggest cost increases. These installers are usually very small businesses, sole proprietors, Baker said. They feel like every place they turn, it's more expensive for them to do business. Investments in automation and centralized purchasing have helped offset some inflationary pressure, but gross margins are lower than they should be, Baker said. He would like to boost rates by 5 to 7%, but thinks a 3 to 4% increase is all customers will tolerate. People are tired of price increases, Baker said. We are tired of price increases. Suddenly, there aren't enough babies. The whole world is alarmed. Birth rates are falling fast across countries with economic, social, and geopolitical consequences. The world is at a startling demographic milestone. Sometime soon, the global fertility rate will drop below the point needed to keep population constant. It may have already happened. Fertility is falling almost everywhere for women across all levels of income, education, and labor force participation. The falling birth rates come with huge implications for the way people live, how economies grow, and the standings of the world's superpowers. Demographics are supposed to be a slow-moving force, but the baby bust is happening so quickly and so widely that it's taken many by surprise. Some estimates now put the number of babies each woman has below the global replacement rate of about 2.2. The United States long ago passed that level. South Korea's rate, the world's lowest, was once unimaginable. In high-income nations, fertility fell below replacement in the 1970s and took a leg down during the pandemic. It's dropping in developing countries, too. India surpassed China as the most populous country last year, yet its fertility is now below replacement. The demographic winter is coming, said Jesus Fernandez Villaverde, an economist specializing in demographics at the University of Pennsylvania. Many government leaders see this as a matter of national urgency. They worry about shrinking workforces, slowing economic growth, and underfunded pensions, and the vitality of a society with ever fewer children. Smaller populations come with diminished global clout, raising questions in the United States, China, and Russia about their long-term standings as superpowers. Some demographers think that the world's population could start shrinking within four decades, one of the few times it's happened in history. Donald Trump, this year's presumptive Republican presidential nominee, has called collapsing fertility a bigger threat to Western civilization than Russia. A year ago, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida declared that the collapse of the country's birth rate left it standing on the verge of whether we can continue to function as a society. Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has prioritized raising the country's demographic GDP. Governments have rolled out programs to stop the decline, but so far they've barely made a dent. In 2017, when the global fertility rate, a snapshot of how many babies a woman is expected to have over her lifetime, was 2.5, the United Nations thought it would slip to 2.4 in the late 2020s. Yet, by 2021, the UN concluded it was already down to 2.3, close to what demographers consider the global replacement rate of about 2.2. The replacement rate, which keeps population stable over time, is 2.1 in rich countries and slightly higher in developing countries, where fewer girls than boys are born and more mothers die during their childbearing years. While the United Nations has yet to publish estimated fertility rates for 2022 and 2023, Fernandez Villaverde has produced his own estimate by supplementing UN projections with actual data for those years covering roughly half the world's population. He has found that national birth rate registries are typically reporting births 10 to 20% below what the UN projected. China reported 9 million births last year, 16% less than projected in the UN's central scenario. In the U.S., 3.59 million babies were born last year, 4% less than the UN projected. In other countries, the undershoot is even larger. Egypt reported 17% fewer births last year. In 2022, Kenya reported 18% fewer. Fernandez Villaverde estimates global fertility fell to between 2.1 and 2.2 last year, which he said would be below global replacement for the first time in human history. Dean Spears, a population economist at the University of Texas at Austin, said that while the data isn't good enough to know precisely when or if fertility has fallen below replacement, we have enough evidence to be quite confident about the crossing point not being far off. In 2017, the UN projected world population, then 7.6 billion, would keep climbing to 11.2 billion in 2100. By 2022, it had lowered and brought forward the peak to 10.4 billion in the 2080s. That, too, is likely out of date. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington now thinks it will peak around 9.5 billion in 2061 and then start declining. In the United States, a short-lived pandemic baby boom, boomlet, has reversed. The total fertility rate fell to 1.62 last year, according to provisional government figures, the lowest on record. Had fertility stayed near 2.1, where it stood in 2007, the U.S. would have welcomed an estimated 10.6 million more babies since, according to Kenneth Johnson, senior demographer at the University of New Hampshire. In 2017, when the fertility rate was 1.8, the Census Bureau projected it would converge over the long run to 2. It has since revised that down to 1.5. It has snuck up on us, said Melissa Kearney, an economist at the University of Maryland specializing in demographics. Historians refer to the decline of fertility that began in the 18th century in industrializing countries as the demographic transition. As lifespans lengthened and more children survived to adulthood, the impetus for burying more children declined. As women became better educated and joined the workforce, they delayed marriage and childbirth, resulting in fewer children. Now, said Spears, the big picture fact is that birth rates are low or are falling in many diverse societies and economies. Some demographers see this as part of a second demographic transition, a society-wide reorientation toward individualism that puts less emphasis on marriage and parenthood and makes fewer or no children more acceptable. In the U.S., some thought at first that women were simply delaying childbirth because of lingering economic uncertainty from the 2008 financial crisis. In research published in 2021, the University of Maryland's Kearney and two co-authors looked for possible explanations for the continued drop. They found that state-level differences in parental abortion notification laws, unemployment, Medicaid availability, housing costs, contraceptive usage, religiosity, childcare costs, and student debt could explain almost none of the decline. We suspect that this shift reflects broad societal changes that are hard to measure or quantify, they conclude. Kearney said while raising children is no more expensive than before, parents' preferences and perceived constraints have changed. If people have a preference for spending time building a career on leisure, relationships outside the home, that's more likely to come in conflict with childbearing. Meanwhile, time use data show that mothers and fathers, especially those that are highly educated, spend more time with their children than in the past. The intensity of parenting is a constraint, Kearney said. Erica Pittman, a 45-year-old business banker in Raleigh, North Carolina, said that she and her husband opted to have only one child because of demands on their time, including caring for her mother, who died last year after a long battle with multiple sclerosis. Their 8-year-old son is able to participate in theater workshops, soccer, and summer camps because the couple, with a combined income of about $225,000 a year, has more time and money. "I feel like a better mom," Pittman said. "I feel like I can go to work because I have a fairly demanding job, but I can also make time to volunteer at a school, be the chaperone for the field trip, and do those kind of things because I only have to have one to coordinate with my schedule." Pittman said she only questions their decision when her son says he wishes he had a sibling to play with. In response, she and her husband, a middle school history teacher, pick vacation destinations with a kids club such as a Disney cruise so her son can play with others his age. Fertility is below replacement in India, even though the country is still poor and many women don't work, factors that usually sustain fertility. Urbanization and the internet have given even women in traditionally male-dominated villages a glimpse of societies where fewer children and a higher quality of life are the norm. "People are plugged into global culture," said Richard Jackson, president of the Global Aging Institute, a nonprofit research and education group. May Marianne Thomas, 38 years old, who lives in Mumbai and runs an audio production company, says she's opted against having children because she never felt the tug of motherhood. She sees peers struggling to meet the right person, getting married later, and in some instances, divorcing before they have kids. "At least 3 of her friends have frozen their eggs," she said. "I think now we live in a really different world, so I think for anyone in the world, it's tough to find a partner," she said. Sub-Saharan Africa once appeared resistant to the global slide in fertility, but that too is changing. The share of all women of reproductive age using modern contraception grew from 17% in 2012 to 23% in 2022, according to Family Planning 2030, an international organization. Jose Ramon, a professor of public health at Johns Hopkins University, credits that to a push by national leaders in Africa, which he predicted would drive fertility down faster than the UN projects. Once a low fertility cycle kicks in, it effectively resets a society's norms and is thus hard to break, said Jackson. The fewer children you see your colleagues and peers and neighbors having, it changes the whole social climate, he said. Danielle Vermeer grew up third in a family of four on Chicago's north side, where her neighborhood was filled with Catholics of Italian, Irish, and Polish descent, and half her close friends had as many siblings as her or more. Her Italian-American father was one of four children who produced 14 grandchildren. Now her parents have five grandchildren, including Vermeer's two children, ages 4 and 7. The 35-year-old, who is the co-founder of a fashion thrifting app, said that before setting out to have children, she consulted dozens of other couples in her Catholic church and read at least 8 books on the subject, including one by Pope Paul VI. She and her husband settled on 2 as the right number. The act of bringing a child into this world is an incredible responsibility, she said. Governments have tried to reverse the fall in fertility with pronatalist policies. Perhaps no country has been trying longer than Japan. After fertility fell to 1.5 in the early 1990s, the government rolled out a succession of plans that included parental leave and subsidized childcare. Fertility kept falling. In 2005, Kuniko Inoguchi was appointed the country's first minister responsible for gender equality and birth rate. The main obstacle, she declared, was money. People could not afford to get married or have children. Japan made hospital maternity care free and introduced a stipend paid upon birth of the child. Japan's fertility rate climbed from 1.26 in 2005 to 1.45 in 2015, but then it started declining again, and in 2022 was back to 1.26. This year, Prime Minister Fumio Kishida rolled out yet another program to increase births that extend monthly allowances to all children under 18 regardless of income, free college for families with 3 children, and fully paid parental leave. Inoguchi, now a member of Parliament's upper house, said the constraint on would-be parents is no longer money, but time. She has pressed the government and businesses to adopt a 4-day work week. She said, if you're a government official or manager of a big corporation, you should not worry over questions of salary now, but that in 20 years' time, you will have no customers, no clients, no applicants to the self-defense forces. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has pushed one of Europe's most ambitious natality agendas. Last year, he expanded tax benefits for mothers so that women under the age of 30 who have a child are exempt from paying personal income tax for life. That's on top of housing and child care subsidies, as well as generous maternity leaves. Hungary's fertility rate, though still well below replacement, has risen since 2010. But the Vienna Institute of Demography attributed this primarily to women delaying childbirth because of a debt crisis that hit around 2010. Adjusted for that, fertility has risen only slightly, it concluded. In the U.S., while state and federal legislators have pushed to expand child care subsidies and parental leave, they have generally not set a higher birth rate as an explicit goal. Some Republicans, though, are leaning in that direction. Last year, Trump said he backed paying out baby bonuses to prop up U.S. births, and GOP Arizona Senate candidate Carrie Lake recently endorsed the idea. Republican Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio said falling fertility matters beyond the economic pressures of a smaller labor force and unfunded Social Security. Do you live in communities where there are smiling, happy children or where people are just aging? He said in an interview. Lack of siblings and cousins, he said, contributes to children's social isolation. He studied potential solutions, in particular Hungary's approach, but has not seen proof of anything that works over the long term. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation found little evidence that pronatalist policies lead to sustained rebounds in fertility. A woman may get pregnant sooner to capture a baby bonus, researchers say, but likely won't have more kids over the course of her lifetime. With no reversal in birth rates in sight, the attendant economic pressures are intensifying. Since the pandemic, labor shortages have become endemic throughout developed countries. That will only worsen in coming years as the post-crisis fall in birth rates yields an ever-shrinking inflow of young workers, placing more strain on healthcare and retirement systems. Neil Howe, a demographer at Hedgeye Risk Management, has pointed to a recent World Bank report suggesting that worsening demographics could make this a second consecutive lost decade for global economic growth. The usual prescription in advanced countries is more immigration, but that has two problems. As more countries confront stagnant population, immigration between them is a zero-sum game. Historically, host countries have sought skilled migrants who entered through formal legal channels, but recent inflows have been predominantly unskilled migrants, often entering illegally and claiming asylum. High levels of immigration have also historically aroused political resistance, often over concerns about cultural and demographic change. A shrinking native-born population is likely to intensify such concerns. Many of the leaders keenest to raise birth rates are most resistant to immigration. As birth rates fall, more regions and communities experience depopulation with consequences ranging from closed schools to stagnant property values. Less selective colleges will soon struggle to fill classrooms because of the plunge in birth rates that began in 2007, said Fernandez Villaverde. Vance said, rural hospitals cannot stay open because of the falling local population. An economy with fewer children will struggle to finance pensions and health care for growing ranks of elderly. South Korea's National Pension Fund, one of the world's largest, is on track to be depleted by 2055. A special legislative committee recently presented several possible pension reforms, but there's only a short window to act before the next presidential election campaign heats up. There's been little public pressure to act, said Sok Chul Song, an economist at Seoul National University. The elderly are not very interested in pension reform, and the youth are apathetic towards politics, he said. It is truly an ironic situation. How the maple syrup cartel keeps a sticky grip on global market. Quebec's 50 million maple trees produce 72% of the world's supply, leaving Vermont to pine for the good old days. Quebec and Vermont are their nation's respective champions of maple syrup making. It isn't a fair fight. Vermont, about 9,600 square miles, has maple as the official state flavor and boasts of more than 6 million sugar maple and red maple trees on tap. Quebec is a 595,000 square mile province and a country that features a maple leaf on its national flag and hosts a maple syrup cartel. Its 50 million syrup producing maple trees yield around 72% of the world's supply. Quebec's Global Maple Syrup Strategic Reserve, three high-security warehouses big enough to hold 221,000 barrels, allows the cartel to regulate global prices. Without much argument, Quebec is known as the Saudi Arabia of maple syrup. Vermonter Pat LeClaire isn't particularly impressed. I was talking to a producer up in Quebec, and I said, "You guys make the quantity, but we make the quality," said LeClaire, 68 years old. He runs a maple farm of 1,200 trees in Charlotte, Vermont, and started making maple syrup on his family's farm when he was 8 years old. LeClaire sticks to the old-fashioned ways. He uses a wood fire to slowly boil the water of the maple sap, leaving behind the glutinous sweetener. "I compare boiling sap to Italian cooking," he said. "The longer it stays in the pan and it's boiling, the more caramelization of the sugars takes place. We feel like we get a more robust maple taste." Around 100 miles north in rural Quebec, 64-year-old David Hall also learned to boil maple syrup sap into thick amber-colored syrup as a boy, sitting with his family around a crackling fire on early spring days. He now runs a modern operation. Miles of plastic tubes attached to vacuum pumps lead to an assembly line of reverse osmosis machines, oil-fueled evaporators and filter presses that turn the sap from 15,000 maple trees into syrup shipped around the world. There's always going to be people who want it the old-fashioned way, Hall said, but we don't milk our cows by hand anymore. It's the evolution of the business. Hall makes more syrup at a lower cost than the traditional method his family practiced when they entered the business in the 1860s. People wouldn't be able to afford syrup if he made it the old way, he said. Among the advances helping Quebec dominate maple syrup making is wide use of the reverse osmosis machine, which separates the water from the sugar in sap, replacing the slow boil method. The technology, including the vacuum tubes, can increase syrup yield by 200%, said Aaron Whiteman, co-director of Cornell University's maple program, which researches maple syrup production. For people that want to make a full-time business out of making maple syrup, that's the trade-off, Whiteman said. It's not Grandpa sitting here in his flannels enjoying himself smoking a pipe. Harry Kessels wears noise-canceling headphones when he checks his maple syrup operation in the backwoods of Ontario, Canada. I won't go into my sugar shack without them, he said. The loud whir and clang of machinery turning sap from 12,000 trees into syrup is the sound of the modern maple farm, Kessels says. LeClaire and other traditionalists say modern processing robs syrup of some flavor. Others disagree. Scientists at the University of Vermont's Proctor Maple Research Center conducted blind taste tests from 2008 to 2011 to settle the matter. Researchers asked 26 people to taste maple syrup made from the same sap using reverse osmosis machines as well as traditional methods. They concluded that the tasters could not tell the difference, said Abby Vanderberg, who led the study. Europeans landing in North America watched indigenous people harvest maple tree sap. They learned to bore holes into the bark and collect sap as it dripped into buckets hanging below. It's very seductive, said Louis Cotty, 72 years old, a Vermont maple syrup maker who learned the old ways. For the first 10 years, Cotty carried buckets on a yoke up a big hill at his sugar farm in the Green Mountains east of Lake Champlain. He started his business in 1976 on a whim and made ends meet as a carpenter. Sugaring tends to be high on romance and low on profitability, he said. Cotty did not turn a profit until he abandoned the buckets for plastic tubes, vacuum pumps, and reverse osmosis machines. It cost him several $100,000 for a system to accommodate 10,000 trees. It took several years for the investment to pay off. The taste of his syrup got better, Cotty said. Emma Marvin taps 30,000 maple trees on her 860-acre Butternut Mountain farm, about an hour's drive northeast of Burlington, Vermont. Her father started the business and was an early adopter of vacuum pumps, which use air pressure to draw more sap from the trees. Marvin now uses all the latest equipment. In her backyard, though, Marvin used buckets to collect sap from taps and four backyard maple trees. She boiled the sap over a fire pit. It looked awful, Marvin said, but it tasted phenomenal. I'm sure some of it was worth the effort that made it taste so delicious. Walmart to lay off and relocate workers. Retailers cutting hundreds of corporate jobs and asking some staff to move to large corporation hubs. Walmart is cutting hundreds of corporate jobs and asking most remote workers to move to offices, according to people familiar with the matter. In addition, workers in small offices in Dallas, Atlanta, and Toronto are being asked to move to other central hubs like Walmart's corporate headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas, as well as Hoboken, New Jersey, or Northern California, said one of the people familiar with the matter. Walmart will still allow staff to work remotely part of the time as long as they are in offices the majority of the time. Walmart is the country's largest employer with 1.6 million U.S. workers, most of them in stores and warehouses. It has tens of thousands of U.S. corporate workers across the country. Like other companies, Walmart has gradually moved away from remote work flexibility and has also shrunk the number of smaller offices scattered around the country. Last year, it closed three tech offices and asked some staff to relocate to central corporate hubs. Walmart has worked to cut costs over the past year in some areas as it gives priority to spending elsewhere. Last month, the company said that it would shut all 51 of the health clinics it has opened over the past 5 years as it tried to build a bigger health care business. The clinics, often located directly next to stores, offered primary care services and telehealth appointments. Last year, Walmart said it was planning to have 75 of the clinics by the end of 2024. Walmart said last month that rising operating costs and a challenging reimbursement environment make the care business unsustainable for us at this time. Melinda French Gates is resigning from the Gates Foundation. She and Bill Gates founded the philanthropy, one of the world's largest, in 2000. Melinda French Gates, one of the most influential philanthropists in the world, is resigning from the foundation that she started with her ex-husband, Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates. She said she's moving into the next chapter with her philanthropy and, as part of an agreement with Gates, will receive $12.5 billion to commit to her work on behalf of women and girls. Her last day of work with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where she is co-chair with Gates, will be June 7th. Mark Suzman, CEO of the organization, said its name is changing to the Gates Foundation, and Gates will be its sole chair. In a LinkedIn post, he said French Gates would not take any of the foundation's work with her when she left. The foundation, created by French Gates and Gates in 2000, is one of the world's largest, with more than 2,000 employees and an endowment of $75.2 billion as of the end of last year. It is well known for its work in global health, particularly polio eradication, malaria, and tuberculosis treatment, as well as poverty and gender equality. French Gates, 59 years old, and Gates, 68 years old, have run the foundation as equal partners. They each have their own areas of interest, with Gates leaning toward medicine and French Gates focusing on gender equality. Their divorce, finalized in August 2021, shook the world of philanthropy, raising questions about the future of the foundation. The two had agreed that she would resign with additional funds for her own philanthropic work if, after 2 years following their divorce, either one decided joint leadership was not working. She decided last summer to stay with the foundation. French Gates' announcement of her departure comes about 3 years after she and Gates said that they would divorce. The news of French Gates' departure came as a surprise to some Gates Foundation employees, who learned about it in an email from Suzman on Monday morning. French Gates has been engaged recently in Gates Foundation work. She represented the foundation in April at events around IMF and World Bank meetings in Washington, D.C., where she advocated for women's economic empowerment. There were some efforts involving French Gates that were still in the works soon before she announced her departure. While their teams had sometimes clashed since the divorce, French Gates and her ex-husband had been presenting a united front. They presided together at internal meetings in December on foundation strategy and had been working together to run the foundation. "This is not a decision I came to lightly," she wrote Monday on social media. "I am immensely proud of the foundation that Bill and I built together and of the extraordinary work it is doing to address inequities around the world." Gates, in an online post, thanked French Gates for her contributions to the foundation. He said he remained fully committed to the foundation. "I am sorry to see her leave, but I am sure she will have a huge impact in her future philanthropic work," Gates said. French Gates and Gates have given the foundation $59.5 billion, while Warren Buffett, who resigned as a Gates Foundation trustee in 2021, has given it $39.3 billion. The two founders have worked with the public sector and used their connections with other wealthy people to attack problems jointly. They have sometimes drawn criticism from public health experts for the large role that their wealth has allowed them to play, choosing which diseases to prioritize and how. "All we do is spend our money and we share our opinions," Gates told the Wall Street Journal in 2020. "We're not making the decision at the end of the day." French Gates, Gates, and Buffett created the Giving Pledge in 2010 to encourage wealthy people to donate the majority of their wealth to charitable causes. French Gates has a net worth of $13.3 billion, according to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index, while Gates's personal wealth is valued at $153 billion. He is the fifth richest person in the world. In late 2021, French Gates published her own giving pledge, saying that she would donate the bulk of her fortune to a variety of causes instead of just the Gates Foundation, including to the firm she founded in 2015, Pivotal Ventures, which makes grants and investments. French Gates on Monday did not elaborate on how she would continue her philanthropic efforts. Pivotal, whose goals include increasing the number of women in tech and running for public office, said it has invested hundreds of millions in organizations in the U.S., and French Gates in 2019 committed $1 billion through Pivotal for Gender Equality. French Gates, who has a bachelor's degree in computer science and economics and an MBA, both from Duke University, spent a decade working at Microsoft, where she met Gates before leaving to focus on her family and philanthropy. The two were married for more than 25 years. She was initially publicly shy, despite her work at the highly visible foundation, only agreeing to her first major solo profile in 2008 in Fortune magazine. She pushed the organization to empower women and improve their lives, including focusing on family planning and reducing maternal and infant mortality. The strategies and the mission of the foundation are joint, but then we'll take priority areas, she told the Journal in 2014. We can get more bang for the buck doing that, and we get more time to really learn deeply about the issues. She represented the foundation among gatherings of the elite, such as Davos, and in frequent travel to developing countries. She wove the work of the foundation with her personal life, saying she and Gates would detour from family vacations to check on projects and using the example of her three children, each born 3 years apart, to underscore the importance of family planning. And that is the news from the Wall Street Journal for Tuesday, May 14th, 2024. I'm Jenny Pleiman, and until next time, stay healthy and keep safe.